they're preparing to do Points West live, so watch Points West and
Alex
see
Level, that's
see,
the one.
Alex Level, thank you. See us walking up and down in the background. We're going to try and get a photo bomb ourselves on telly.
That'll be fun, won't it, with all the different logos. And Susie Purdy, what's planning? I understand we had green smoke from that pipe earlier.
Yeah, I think it is a go for the flight this evening. So there will be a mass launch that will be happening shortly as the balloons go up. The Minion's looking a little bit sad at the moment, but he will be up straight soon, along with all the others. And then they'll be going over Bristol. I don't know which direction they're going in. But,
not sure either.
We'll find it out.
All right, so straight after the politics show with Tony Gosling, we're going to be live from Ashton Court. If you want to follow us on Twitter at BCFM Radio or on the BCFM Radio Facebook page. There'll be live video updates. You can listen to the politics and watch and look at the pictures. Right, back to you, Tony, in the studio.
Thanks, Pat. And I also helped to tick off Steve Satan there for saying listen to Points West, because actually you're going to get much more on this show.
I think of the establishment, our establishment, as a kind of a legal mafia, whose watchword really is the watchword of the real mafia, omerta, silence.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Rain Man or Fall Guy? Scores of banksters chuckle. Tom Hayes is scapegoated for the LIBOR fraud, which made them billions. Also, no justice, no peace, so the demonstrators' chant goes. But can there be justice with massive cuts to the legal aid bill? Any tin pot dictator knows the best way to get his way is to take over the courts. But could the same be happening here in Britain with only the rich getting lawyers? Also, the strange case of Alexander Litvinenko, Russian investigative journalist, who came to a sticky end in London. Like Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, he was poisoned with radioactive polonium. What was his relationship with the exiled Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky? Also, as Turkey changes targets from ISIS to the PKK, the US follows suit by announcing they will start to target the allies of President Bashar Assad in Syria. Meanwhile, the Russian parachute forces chief Vladimir Shamanov gets a ticking off from Vladimir Putin, the president, for announcing his boys are ready to descend on Syria and lend Uncle Sam a hand in fighting ISIS. Because despite satellites and the latest technology money combined, the Americans seem to be having a lot of trouble hitting them. We start this week with LIBOR trader Tom Hayes, who's been jailed for 14 years. Is the long sentence just a just punishment, or to keep him from giving evidence to journalists and the courts about his managers and directors that knew exactly what he was up to? Billionaire bosses at RBS, Royal Bank of Canada, Citigroup, and Union Bank of Switzerland. We heard on this show from former US Army officer Scott Bennett a few weeks ago, UBS was channeling secret money to ISIS just before he was sacked on trumped up charges. Too big to jail banksters. Is that why Tom Hayes wasn't allowed to turn Queen's evidence? Anyway, I'm joined on the line now by a financial journalist at the Scottish Sunday Herald, or Scottish Herald, or Glasgow Herald, Ian Fraser. Hi, Ian, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Tell us a bit about the Tom Hayes case and give us your assessment as to whether it really is a great success for the Serious Fraud Office, as we're being told.
Well, the Serious Fraud Office clearly has had a few setbacks in recent years, and it's, you know, failed with the Chengguez brothers, or it, you know, they ended up suing it because of a botched inquiry into their affairs. There's been, you know, it's meant to be the lead prosecuting agency for financial fraud, for white collar crime in the UK, but it hasn't probably, it's probably seen as not having taken enough scalps. So the fact they have successfully prosecuted Tom Hayes is being presented by David Green, who's the head of the SFO, as a major coup. And he sees it as something that's going to ensure the survival of the agency, because its future has been in jeopardy. And I think that Theresa May wants to merge it in with the NCA, which is the National Crime Agency, formerly known as the Serious Organized Crime Agency, I think.
Oh, yeah, that's but what they're calling Britain's FBI, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But, I mean, it's difficult to say with Tom Hayes. I mean, clearly he was, in terms of implementing the rigging of LIBOR, which is a massive crime. You know, it's described as the largest felony in the history of the world by William K. Black, professor at an American university. And in terms of people who were actually implementing it on a daily basis, he was doing that, and he was the ringleader. So the fact that he has been banged up for 14 years could be considered to be, you know, inverted commas, a good thing. But you're right, there are people higher up within UBS and within the other banks where he worked, which included RBS and Royal Bank of Canada and Citigroup, who were aware of and who condoned his activities. And in UBS, there was even a manual which was called How to Rig LIBOR, which I believe existed before he arrived at the bank. Although I need to check that. And these guys were, you know, so it wasn't as if he was some rogue trader operating in total isolation, which is often what people try and pretend in these sorts of cases. He was given a larger golden hello and larger bonuses with each of the successive banks for which he by each of the successive banks for which he worked.
Now that's interesting, this whole business of a manual of how to rig LIBOR. How can he possibly be a mastermind if he's actually being handed a manual on how to commit this fraud?
Well, that's a good question, and I'd actually need to check to see when that manual was first created.
Well, I don't think there's any implication that Tom Hayes wrote it. I mean, he was handed this. He said, look, this is what they gave me when I arrived at the bank.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen the manual. It was something that was mentioned in the court case.
No, and maybe anybody that sees it would be, you know, it should be one of those banned books or something. Because it's clearly, and you're absolutely right about the depth of this fraud. But what I suppose I'm trying to get to here is, I mean, there's been quite a lot more part of his evidence. Tom was saying that the German markets chief, he's the guy who's now in charge of the entire German stock market, a guy called Carsten Kengetter, chief executive of Deutsche Börse now he is. He sat in on the meetings, which is what Tom Hayes said. And at those meetings, LIBOR manipulation was discussed according to evidence given to the Serious Fraud Office by Tom Hayes. So, I mean, surely if these senior people are in on these meetings where LIBOR rigging is being discussed, where perhaps you know, manuals on how to do it are being handed out, surely these people are part of the conspiracy and should be prosecuted too, not just one Tom Hayes.
Yeah, I totally agree they should. One of the problems in banking is the deniability factor becomes higher the higher up the ranks you get, because at the top of the banks, you know, they will only be have a passing knowledge of that area. So it is a problem as far as the actual nuts and bolts of putting a prosecution together are concerned.
Yeah,
it is harder to prosecute the so-called low-hanging fruit.
Yes,
for
well,
people like Tom Hayes than it is the ultimate bosses of UBS.
But I mean, he's made it clear that at UBS, quite possibly at the other banks that he was in, that there were there were some of his managers who were in on these meetings, and also these people were hiring him specifically because they knew he had a reputation for being able to rig LIBOR. Surely that makes them part. This is what I'm trying to get at here. It's surely that makes them part of a conspiracy, because it seems, how can you have a conspiracy where only Tom Hayes has been prosecuted?
Well, you won't. I mean, David Green, who's the SFO guy, gave an interview to The Guardian in which he said they will be going after, and I don't think he gave a number, but I think it's about 12 other people who either work for UBS or other banks, including RBS and Barclays and HSBC, I would imagine, because they've already done regulatory settlements at a group level over LIBOR rigging, and brokerages including ICAP and Martin, There's one called R.P. Martin, I think it's called. So there will be, there, as far as I'm aware, according to the interview that Green gave to The Guardian, there will be other people being prosecuted for the same or similar offences of trying to rig LIBOR. But my fear is that they will focus on the trader level of people rather than their bosses. And I agree with you, it's wrong. It's totally wrong because the bosses are implicated because they knew it was happening and they made no attempt to stop it. And they benefited financially, both in terms of their own bonuses and the profitability of their banks.
Well, I mean, depending on what witnesses say, if they're in on meetings as well, I mean, the most shocking revelation this week is digging into this story and finding that this guy who's the head of the chief executive of the German stock exchange is sitting in on meetings with Tom Hayes as this is going on. I would have imagined that there would be, you know, that he wouldn't be just standing there if he was making notes, that he's actually involved in the whole thing.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, is there any clamour in Germany for this guy to be prosecuted or to be fired from his job as the head of the German Stock Exchange?
Well, no.
No.
There is no. In fact,
there certainly should.
And maybe it's something to do with the nature of these sorts of crimes. You've mentioned there, Ian, that this is one of the biggest crimes ever in the history of the world or whatever.
Yeah.
That could you just explain to us what is the LIBOR rate and to what extent ordinary people like you and I, maybe people with mortgages, with bank loans, get affected by the crimes that Tom and his co-conspirators were perpetrating?
Okay, well, LIBOR is a benchmark which is set in London. That's why it's called, it stands for London Interbank Offered Rate. And it was set up in about 1988 to sort of formalise the rate at which the larger banks were lending money to each other, and it underpins about, I think it's about 350 trillion of loans, mortgages, derivatives, and other financial instruments. So it's the kind of benchmark against which a huge amount by value of financial products it's the benchmark interest rate, which underpins, you know, a huge number of financial products worldwide. And I think basically the way it affects us is it's quite difficult to know exactly the extent to which the rigging that Tom Hayes was responsible for would actually affect the price that you pay on a UK mortgage. But if, for example, he was nudging it up on a particular day, if it's a floating rate product, then that would increase the cost of the loan on that day. If he was nudging it down, if he was successfully nudging it down on another day, it would actually make the cost of that product less for the consumer or the end borrower. So, you know, it's hard to explain exactly how it affects people's day-to-day lives, but it does. And if it's corrupted, as it was according to the regulators, between 2006 and 2010, although a lot of people believe it was being rigged long before that, then, you know, it's kind of like undermining the fundamental benchmark that's underpinning all these financial products and making a mockery of it, really. Because for a start, on short-term swap trades, the banks can profit, you know, as anyone who's read the regulatory settlements that the US regulators and the UK regulators published between 2012 and 2013 with the various banks, and there's about 12 of them that settled on these matters. You can see they were doing it in order to basically fleece their counterparties, you know, or their investors with whom they were trading, because they had a hidden secret, which was they knew what the rate was going to do the next day. Therefore, they could make a spectacular profit on certain types of complex financial products, and essentially fleece their counterparties, the people with whom they were trading.
Well, effectively, that's us down the end of the line.
Yeah.
Also, this does indicate. I mean, Mark Carney, of course, from the Royal Bank of Canada. And one of the people that was one of the companies that Tom Hayes was working for. I wonder if they ever had a little chat. You know, you don't know, do you? And if he did, was Carney also possibly one of these co-conspirators? But I mean,
I don't think that's accurate, because I think Carney was at the Bank of Canada, which is the central bank.
Not the Royal Bank of Canada.
No. I'm aware of.
Lucky for him, Mr. Carney, then. Well done. He's in the right bank at the right time. also, I mean, there was another brilliant article, I thought, in a publication I'd not come across online before, eFinancial Careers, which points out the people who are named as the co-conspirators with Tom Hayes and what they're doing now. One of them, named Mirat Aliklov, one of the journalists from there, Sarah Butcher, traced down. She said, while Hayes is languishing in a cell, Aliklov seems to be getting on with his career and having fun. He's also recorded as a CrossFit athlete and has been participating in executive fight nights. And that's just a brief trawl of the internet, looking for what's happened to some of the other people who were accused at the same time as Tom was.
Yeah, Sarah Butcher is a good journalist, and she, you know, that was a very interesting article because, you know, to extend that showed the injustice of it. They happened to have singled out, you know, Tom Hayes, and presumably some of the other ones as well. But there are others who are just as culpable, or perhaps just as culpable, who are, you know, enjoying their freedom.
Is there any prospect, do you think, of more senior people? People who are actually making bigger bonuses than Tom Hayes was, for example, senior management directors of these banks actually going to jail? Because there are, for example, the Rona Fairhead, from the chairman of the BBC, she's also on the risk committee of HSBC, and she's been accused in a private prosecution. Prosecution in the United States for money laundering as well, the Daily Mail announced last year, because it seems that it's not just these individual cases to do with maybe foreign exchange or LIBOR, but there are other problems and more serious money laundering you might consider more serious than the LIBOR fixing.
Well, I think one of the worst problems since the global financial crisis of 2008 is the failure to prosecute senior bankers who were to a large extent responsible, and who were in some cases clearly committing fraud. And you know, it's one of the biggest running sores that the UK, US, and other developed markets have experienced, I think, since the global financial crisis, is the lack of appetite of prosecutorial agencies and Department of Justice in the States and the SFO here to go after the top guys. And you know, that it was different after the, as Bill Black will tell you, it was different after the saving and loan crisis in the US in the late 80s and early 90s, when chairman, chief executive, and chief financial officers were prosecuted, and largely of smaller banks, it has to be said. And many of them did end up in jail. I think it was between 100 and 200 senior bankers ended up in jail after the savings and loan crisis of the late 80s and early 90s. So something changed in the mindset of governments and of the justice departments and prosecution agencies during the 90s and 2000s, which for some reason meant that they didn't even bother to investigate, let alone prosecute more senior people.
I mean, if this carries on, effectively, you're bound to end up. Maybe we've already got a criminal elite, people who simply are too rich to jail.
Well, this is a key problem, and I mean, you know, I think we've seen this to some extent with HSBC with its money laundering settlement of December 2012, when it handed a check for $1.9 billion to the U.S. authorities, including the Justice Department. As part of a deferred prosecution agreement, and the chairman who oversaw the bank at the time the crimes were committed, who's called Stephen Green, was not penalized in any way, but instead he earlier became a lord. He was made a lord by David Cameron, and he was appointed trade minister by David Cameron. Obviously, there were other things going on in HSBC which were criminal at that time, including the activities of its Swiss private bank. I'm sure you know all about that. But yeah, no, it's just totally unjust. And, you know, you begin to despair after a while. But from the perspective of David Green at the SFO, he probably thinks there's a lack of political appetite to go after the top guys. And he also probably thinks that he has more chance of a successful prosecution if he goes for the people lower down the packing order.
Well, you start to wonder, don't you, whether some of these people who are getting massive bonuses and are not getting prosecuted are then donating money by whatever means to the ruling party.
Well, yeah, that's going on, certainly. A lot of hedge funds have given a lot of money to the Tories. You know, is that bribery? I don't know. they may just say, well, you know, the Tories are more likely to implement free market policies with which we agree. But, you know, it certainly has helped in certain cases.
Also, I noticed Goldman Sachs offered Tom Hayes a $3 million. They don't like to be out of the fun when there's criminality going on. So they offered Tom Hayes $3 million bonus just to quit UBS and to work for them. So Goldman Sachs were after him too.
I know. But do you know why he didn't go there? Did they just decide he wasn't quite good enough at it, or what? I read the report about it was during the court case that came up, and I'd like to check as to the reason why they didn't hire him. Maybe they found that his crimes were too obvious.
Well, it's possible. I mean, also, I know that UBS made some sort of quiet counteroffer to him for him
That's
to stay.
That's quite possible, too, yeah.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we're getting pretty close here to a kind of oligarchy, aren't we, where you've got super-rich bankers and their friends simply paying political parties to make sure that they don't ever get prosecuted, and actually that means that they are way above the law.
Well, it's strange, this case, isn't it? In general, I'd prefer to see individuals named rather than, as in the HSBC case, the organisation pays a fine, but the individuals who actually carried out the money laundering obviously weren't prosecuted. But in this case, you've picked on an individual, Tom Hayes, or they've picked on an individual, Tom Hayes, and you could argue that in actual fact, LIBOR fixing is an institutional crime and that the institutions should pay. I mean, for example, lots of local authorities all over the world, Detroit and so on, have lost an awful lot of money through these interest rate manipulations and are now supposedly bankrupt. Surely the private sector banks which carried out those manipulations should have their assets seized in order to cover the costs that so incurred.
As I said, it looks like we're sitting in the situation where we have effectively got an oligarchy of the super rich who are paying politicians through political donations, this kind of thing, to keep them away. And the politicians obviously are having some influence over what the courts are doing, the justices are doing, the Crown Prosecution Services are doing. How do we break this evil cycle?
Well, by the sort of thing we're doing, people being prosecuted and then discussing what happens when they are prosecuted. I think basically the fundamental problem is that if they're going to prosecute anybody, they've got to prosecute everybody, and that means you're basically calling for the overthrow of the existing financial order, and nobody's got the courage to call for that, because that really means that you've got to change the direction of the way you think about how the financial system operates and what its role is.
It will
come in the end, because all these shenanigans are going to lead, in my view, to another crash. I can't see anything that's going to stop that.
We had something like along those lines happen in Iceland, didn't we, with the arrest of a lot of senior bankers, several of whom were prosecuted, and Iceland is now heading on the road to recovery financially,
although
it's got a lot of debt.
Yeah, but what you've got to remember is what the Icelandic government did is they said that all foreign holders of accounts in Landsbanki and ISAE, for example, British local authorities, they refused to cover their losses. And the British government picked up the losses of the British local authorities that had lost money, and that was added to Britain's national debt, but not to Iceland's. Now, Iceland were able to get away with that because they're a small fry and they're able to just wriggle through the net. But of course, ultimately, the losses have to be borne by somebody and are being borne by the British taxpayer as opposed to the Icelandic taxpayer. Good for the Icelanders, but it's not a general solution unless we're going to go to... You know, we've got to look at the whole picture. And you know, you can't push Iceland as a potential solution for everybody, because the real danger is that if you prosecute properly what's been going on in the City of London, you're basically going to bankrupt it.
One of the big problems here, and I'll ask you the same question in a second, Ian, but one of the big problems here is we've got the 2008 bailout, which effectively was bailing out people who had more than whatever the guaranteed amount at the time was in your bank account, and also bailing out shareholders in banks. And so effectively, that was really, it would have, the only people who would have taken a hit if there hadn't been a bailout in 2008 are either the very rich or bank shareholders.
Is that a question to me?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're in this situation now. That kind of happened in 2008. We're now at the situation where we've got a lot of very powerful, above the law bankers. And I wonder what you think the solution might be.
It's a very difficult one. I mean, just in, one of the things that Martin just said isn't strictly accurate, because for LIBOR rigging in particular, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission in the States and various other U.S. regulators and the Financial Services Authorities, it was then called, but it subsequently became Financial Conduct Authority, did actually penalize the institutions that had rigged the benchmark. So, you know, there seems to be two phases to this one. There was the original penalization and, in some cases, admission of guilty pleas by institutions. And there were approximately 10, but I need to check the exact number. RBS was one of those. UBS was one. And, in fact, UBS paid the biggest fine of all. And the second phase is the, you know, the prosecution of individual traders, which is what we're seeing now and which has started with Tom Hayes. So it's not strictly accurate to say that the institutions haven't been penalized. The fines were actually fairly, you know, fairly hefty compared to fines that have been seen prior to that. But
yeah, but do they make a dent in the profits? Because the profits are doing massive from the LIBOR over many years.
They certainly have done in the case of RBS. You know, RBS, as you know, has basically lost $50 billion in terms of declared losses since it was bailed out in October 08, which is more than the amount of money that the taxpayer put in capital, which was $45.5 billion in October 2008. So one of the reasons why it hasn't been profitable is because it does have recurring fines to pay. And, you know, for example, for foreign exchange market rigging, which is another area that regulators have been looking at, RBS has paid $1.3 billion in fines, combined between various regulators, including US ones and UK ones. So that does make a significant hit on a bank's on that particular bank's profit, to the extent that it has not been declaring profits for certainly over the last 2 or 3 years when it might otherwise have been declaring profits.
But if it's not declaring profits, then surely it's not paying corporation tax either.
No, it's not paying any corporation tax. In fact, it's storing up deferred tax. I can't remember the phrase, but it's actually storing up benefits for the future under deferred tax arrangements, whereby if it makes a loss and doesn't pay any corporation tax, it gets a discount off its tax in future years.
Well, I mean, I have to hand it to you, Ian, for sticking with banking, because it's a little bit like the planning system. It's a bit boring to try and go into it, but actually it's where stuff really happens, and it's important that people actually get to grips with it. And I know you've written a book about RBS, which is which I'm sure you'll tell us a bit about now, because it's doing quite well, isn't it? I don't know, the Financial Times rate it.
Well, they called it one of the books of the decade, one of the best books of the decade, which was rather gratifying. But it was also named as Book of the Year by Huffington Post, by The Week, and by Bloomberg. So I was quite, you know, I was fairly chuffed when that happened last December. But the book is basically the story of RBS from its very first, you know, from its origins in 1727, right the way through to its, you know, its heyday under George Matheson and Fred Goodwin, which was in the 90s and the 2000s, and then the story of its crash, which really was precipitated by its very ill-judged acquisition of ABN AMRO, which happened in October 2007. And then, you know, obviously it became the largest bank failure in history, with assets of $2.2 trillion in October 08, and the most expensive bank in the world to bail out in October 08. But yeah, the book's actually coming out in paperback in October, and I'm just currently working on that. I'm writing an epilogue discussing what's happened to the bank over the past...
Well, I'd imagine you have to bring out a new edition every year with an extra chapter on the end.
Well, I know. It's amazing because, you know, even just in the last 12 months, it's been quite a lot in terms of new fines, you know, new initiatives by the chief exec, Ross McEwan, and in terms of announcements from Osborne that he wants to basically palm it off on private investors as quickly as he possibly can. He wants to, you know, he wants to wash his hands of RBS, and that's why he sold it at a loss. So why he sold the initial tranche of shares at a loss.
Well, I noticed just in the last couple of days there are accusations that there's been fixing going on, so that the taxpayer is getting fleeced again in this latest just this week.
Well, that's right, because on Thursday the UKFI, which is the government agency which is supposedly looking after the taxpayer's stake in RBS, leaked information out into the market that it was about to embark on a sale of up to 10% of the government stake. That became common knowledge in the city amongst hedge funds, who then started to short sell the shares, and so the shares went down. You know, from I think it was about 350 to 330, so they lost 20p in value as a result of that short selling, which helped the hedge funds to make a fast buck, but it actually meant that the taxpayer got less than the taxpayer would otherwise have got for the state that was sold on Monday night. So yeah, there's something very dodgy happened, and I think the key thing is that UKFI stroke the Her Majesty's Treasury should not have leaked the information that they were about to embark on the initial tranche of shares being sold.
Well, maybe that some of these hedge funds have got spies in the Treasury.
Quite possibly. You know, there's spies everywhere, and in fact, one of the extraordinary things about the Treasury nowadays is that it's a lot of the senior staff are either civil servants who've done 5 years in an investment bank, or they're investment bankers who are going to do, you know, 5 years in the Treasury, and there's a massive revolving door between the Treasury and investment banks, and I think actually that is something which probably needs to be addressed, because there's obviously a conflict of interest there.
Yeah, it seems so crooked, Ian. I mean, it's quite depressing. Don't you think it's about time that we brought this into the public sector and managed banking like a utility?
It's interesting because when the French state bought Credit Lyonnais in the 80s, the bank became even more corrupt than it was when it was in private ownership. And it became a massive problem for the French government. So just the mere fact of having something state-owned doesn't necessarily mean it's going to become whiter than white. In the case of Credit Lyonnais, it actually had the opposite effect.
One wonders in a situation like that whether the bankers have decided, right, if they decide they're going to nationalise us, we're going to make them regret it.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
It makes you wonder whether they're saying, well, if they want to nationalise us and start managing us, we're going to make them sure they regret it.
Well, maybe, I don't know. But, I mean, in the case of RBS, there have been various alternative proposals put forward, including one by the New Economics Foundation, which is to split it into about 10 local or regional banks, based, you know, a bit like Sparkassen in the UK, which are actually owned by local government. Local authorities and/or the Länder and the I can't remember what the names are for the regions in Germany, but you know that the trouble with that one is it's in many ways a sensible proposal, because you could hope that you could create smaller units which are more focused on serving the needs of their local economies. And with less capacity to destroy the global economy or the UK economy when they fail, because they're smaller. But the trouble is that as far as, you know, the right-wing ideologues in the current government are concerned, that no bank is better off in the public sector, because they have this mindset of private sector good, public sector bad. So the New Economics Foundation proposals, when they were put to Harriet Baldwin, who's the city minister, who, by the way, worked at JP Morgan Chase for 22 years until she became city minister, and I'm sorry, until she became an MP in 2010, was to just say, look, it's an interesting proposal, but we just believe that things are better off in the private sector.
We didn't even look at it, basically. No. Okay, so I think maybe we'll have a little a pact, if you want, you and I, Ian, and that is to get hold of Tom and see if we can get a list from him of all of the senior bankers, that is bank directors and managers, that he was sharing information about LIBOR with, and make sure it's published. So even if these people aren't prosecuted, at least their names are known. Like, you know, I mentioned Carsten Kengetter, the chief executive of the German bank. We need to get those names out there, I think, so that these people know who they're dealing with.
Well, certainly his dad, who's called Nick Hayes, is absolutely furious about the way his son's been treated. And scapegoated, and has written a letter to the Guardian about this, which I was reading yesterday, and Nick Hayes is also quite active on Twitter, trying to basically criticise the judge and stand up for his son.
Okay, Ian Fraser, blogger and writer for the Scottish Herald, the Glasgow Herald, it used to be called, I think it's now called the Herald of Scotland or something.
The website, Herald Scotland, yeah.
And also author of Shredded, History of RBS. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Good talking to you. Cheers.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, I'm joined now by Will Stone, who's from the Avon and Bristol Law Centre. Will,
Avon and Bristol Law Centre, yes.
Yeah, to talk about another topic, also to do with injustice. And I think most people looking at the Tom Hayes case would see that as a gross misjustice, 14 years behind bars for doing something which senior bankers had. But we're here to discuss some changes to the legal aid system, Will. There's what we really need to know is how has that been impacting, you know, what you've been doing at the Law Centre there?
Well, at the Law Centre, we deal with civil law, and so we've seen the impact of the changes that have been made over the last 2 years to civil legal aid, which means that there are some areas of civil law are completely out of the legal aid scheme now. So, for example, housing with disrepair cases, you can no longer get legal aid in order to try to get your landlord to bring your rented property up to a standard. That's unless you can show that there's a serious risk to your health and safety. Now, most disrepair cases that we see are to do with damp, to do with poorly fitting doors and windows and things like that, things that aren't necessarily going to end up with somebody being in hospital. It is very difficult to get civil legal aid for those type of housing cases. Family is now pretty much out of scope for most cases, unless you can prove that there's a risk of domestic violence. At the Law Centre, we are inundated with people seeking family legal advice from a team of very dedicated volunteer local solicitors who come in on a Tuesday evening, and they see about 6 to 10 people every week. And that has led to the court system being in crisis, because people are having to represent themselves in quite complicated legal proceedings around family law. And that's leading to extended court hearings. The courts can't deal with the amount of cases. Cases are being delayed. We're going to see over the next 5 years half the number of courts, about a third to the half number of courts in the UK, being closed. So that situation is probably only going to get worse. My own particular area of law, which is employment law and discrimination law, employment law, there's no legal aid available for it at all. Coupled with the massive increase in fees that a claimant has to pay to go to an employment tribunal now, means that there was a drop in the first year after the fees were introduced, 70% drop in the number of claims coming through. We've seen in the last few weeks a report produced by the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, which shows that pregnancy discrimination is rife across the whole of the employment spectre, with 1 in 10 women reporting ill treatment at work after they have notified their employer that they're pregnant. That has been echoed this week by the Equality Advisory Support Service, who take calls from the public about discrimination issues, saying that has been a real number one cause of complaint that they've had over the last year or so as well. I can say that from the work that we do at the Law Centre, every week we get at least one or two, usually more, calls from women who have notified their employer that they're pregnant, and then suddenly their previously unblemished work record, there's suddenly problems with it. They're put on capability procedures, they're told their work's not good enough, they find themselves subject to very bizarre disciplinary procedures, or the big catch-all one that usually always happens in the end, they suddenly find that they're made redundant.
I mean, you're painting a pretty sorry picture of this. I mean, this is actually affecting not just your practice, but it's affecting solicitors widely across the city and across the country. And I know certainly last year there was a certain amount of resistance from barristers and solicitors. Has there been much of a pushback by barristers? Because obviously these fees were going to those barristers, no longer they're not getting those fees. I was just driving through a city in South Wales day before yesterday, and I see a solicitor's office to help people with benefit claims. Basically, the whole thing is shut. There's now plants growing out from the broken window where it used to be, and it does seem that this whole area is just simply going down the tubes, Will. I wonder if some of the solicitors are actually making a fuss about this.
They are. I mean, what you were talking about there, the barristers' strike that was last year, that's to do with changes to the criminal legal aid scheme, which is something that we don't deal with at the Law Centre. We don't do criminal law. But at the moment, there's many, many, many solicitors, thousands of solicitors across the whole country are currently boycotting the police duty solicitor schemes because of the cuts that are being proposed, the new schemes that are being proposed by the government, which for a lot of those firms will basically mean that they will be economically unviable and will have to shut down. The other main problem which has been in the news this week has been to do with the criminal courts charge, which is a new type of fine that was introduced last year by the government. That's on top of the usual fines that can be given by magistrates courts, which is it's called the criminal courts charge, and it's added to your fine if you're convicted in a magistrates court or Crown court. The quid pro quo is that if you agree to plead guilty, then that charge will be reduced by about 60%. So many young petty criminals are being told, well, look, you know, if you plead guilty to this, you'll only have to pay a charge of about £100. But if you plead not guilty and we decide that you are guilty, that'll whack up to about £600 or £700.
But I mean, surely there's some justice to that, because if a court case is going to take a long time and it's going to take up a lot of public resources to see it through, then surely whoever's found guilty should pay more.
Well, I can perhaps only quote what a judge at Exeter Crown Court said. A judge at Exeter Crown Court questioned the viability of that charge after he was forced to impose a £900 fee on a homeless shoplifter. And he actually said in the court, he can't even afford to feed himself, so what are the prospects of him paying £900? Now, if he doesn't pay that £900, he could well find himself in prison, because that charge works the same in the same kind of way of somebody who's been convicted and fined for not having a television license, in that it carries a prison sentence if you don't pay it.
It seems we're getting towards the stage where actually poverty is becoming a criminal, you know, where just simply be not being able to pay something or buy something, whether it be criminal, maybe be paying a lawyer or paying these fees, could put people in jail.
Well, the Howard League for Penal Reform has actually produced a press release on this very issue. They're pushing for a review of this charge at the moment. And I can give you two examples that they've put, and is on their website, and it's worth having a look at. A 37-year-old homeless man jumped in front of a car and was jailed for 12 weeks in order to pay £180 criminal courts charge. A 50-year-old homeless man who breached an ASBO by entering an area in Taunton, Somerset that he happened to be barred from, was ordered to pay £180 criminal courts charge. Where are those people going to find that money from? What's eventually going to happen is that they won't pay it. Warrant will go out for their arrest. They'll be taken in and they'll be sent to prison. And our prisons are already creaking under an overcrowded system that just can't cope with the numbers of people that are going in to prison, often for offences which wouldn't normally carry a prison sentence.
Well, what's the effect is this having on civil legal aid lawyers like yourself?
Well, we don't deal with that sort of, that's criminal law. We deal with the civil side. We may very well see some of those homeless people, and we may well try to get them housed. There are limits on what we can do in terms of taking cases to the court. Legal aid is very restricted in the types of cases that you can take. So quite often we're just having to tell people, well, we can't help you, and where they go we don't know. That's not our job to monitor where the people go.
Yeah, also Will, we've heard in the news, I think it's just this week, that landlords are going to be forced or told that they've got to carry out immigration checks as well. It seems like I actually thought that it was the border agency that was supposed to do that, but no, apparently no, it's landlords.
Well, that's new proposals that are going through, that's out to consultation at the moment, is that landlords, at the moment, it will be coming in sometime, I think, this year, that landlords will have to carry out immigration checks in the same way that employers do. But the new proposals that are coming in are that they will have to follow up those checks to check whether their tenant's status is the same as it was, say, 6 months ago, and to ensure that they're not failed asylum seekers or they're not overstayed immigrants, essentially, as you say, Tony, turning them into UK border agency immigration police. Now, what's worrying about this is, as happens with a lot of employers, is this is a very complicated procedure to actually go through. Immigration law is a minefield. It's so complicated that you have to be regulated by the government in order to carry it out. So how can a landlord, whose real main aim is just to make a bit of money by renting out their property, carry out a proper and fair check on somebody's immigration? I've already had complaints coming in from people in Bristol who have been told by letting agencies that they won't let the properties to them because they're people from abroad and they clearly don't understand what the immigration status of the person concerned here is. The people are there, these prospective tenants are here legally, they've even got the documentation to prove it, but it seems that what may happen is that landlords and letting agencies will just stop letting to people who are not very, very obviously UK citizens, and that is discrimination.
It is, isn't it? White British only for landlords, and if they don't, if they let somebody else in with the wrong accent, even they might even think, well, okay, I'm not going to be able to give them somewhere to live. Absolutely shocking. Anyway, Will, wonder whereabouts people can find Avon and Bristol Law Centre and what kinds of work you still can do under the legal aid system.
Well, we carry out social welfare law, so we can deal with discrimination cases, we can deal with employment cases, we can deal with some immigration cases, we can deal with housing cases, we deal with mental health cases and with community care and welfare benefits. You can find us on Stokescroft, and we're at number 2 Moon Street, just on the corner there on Stokescroft. Our telephone number is 0117 924 8662. You can look at our website, which is www.ablc.co.uk. all the information you need will be on there.
So go and use Avon Bristol Law Centre while we still have something in Britain called legal aid. Thanks, Will Stone, very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
our old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers. We have to whip through the final part of the show where we've got quite a lot to talk about, because we've had this amazing revelations about Edward Heath this week. I think it's now 7 police forces and a national squad being set up to investigate his involvement with child sexual abuse, alleged involvement anyway, even though he's dead, we have to say that, because it is still just about alleged. Isn't it interesting? And I think it was January 2013 we had an interview on the show on this very subject.
Well, indeed, but as George Ferguson pointed out earlier, we still don't know that that these people are guilty, and we've got to be very careful presuming that they are.
Well, one other person who also seems to think that there were some problems with Edward Heath over in Jersey is Leah McGrath Goodman, and she was arrested about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and banned from Britain for 2 years. She's a journalist with a totally clean record, no criminal convictions, but she was arrested at Heathrow because she was going off to Jersey to investigate this, and she was detained for 12 hours with no charges. And this is what she was going to investigate and what she'd heard about Edward Heath.
On the island, it was very widespread that he had enjoyed using his yacht. It was called the Morning Cloud. And he would come to the island quite frequently. And from what I understand, he would take the children from care homes for rides on the yacht. And it was reported that some of those children never came back. I think the hardest thing is if true, it's not going to be easy to find a person who can say it happened to them, right? So I think the difficulty here is figuring out what took place on the yacht once it left port and went into international waters. I know that the police receive reports. I have looked into the records at the care home that he used to frequent. From what I understand, it was called Hot de la Garen, and it was also the care home that Jimmy Savile liked to frequent. Quite a few VIPs and high-ranking people in the government and in public life would go to this home, not just in Jersey on the island, but also from the UK mainland would go to this home. And the children, they were loaned out quite regularly to high-level people, and they were often brought back. Sometimes not. The records will say things like the child ran away, that sort of thing, but there was no effort to find them.
And do you believe that the British government has been complicit in covering up these allegations as you have found?
I can say that in my experience working on this for quite some time, they have not been very helpful. I think it would take a lot to prove that it's all on purpose. However, I've seen a pattern of trying very hard to look the other way. Maybe it's not deliberate, but it's certainly quite a pattern and quite a coincidence that every time people try to take the matter and bring it to somebody in authority, that it never seems to go anywhere.
And that's Leah McGrath Goodman speaking on London station LBC earlier this week. Martin, the question has to be, well, if there was nothing to find about Edward Heath, why was she arrested and deported and banned from Britain for 2 years and detained for 12 hours with no charge?
Well, I keep coming back to the point I keep making about these VIP defiles, is the role of the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, where the security services were using young boys as honey traps for blackmailing politicians and others and paramilitaries. And that's been rumbling away in Northern Ireland all the time, and is now being included in the recent investigations. And I think what underpins all of this is the use of paedophilia by the security services for blackmail purposes, and that's why it's all been covered up.
The other interesting side of this is Michael Shrimpton, the barrister who we interviewed on this programme, and I'll put a link to that interview back in the beginning January 2013. He's now in jail, isn't he, on these charges of apparently a false nuclear bomb hoax that he wired into the Defence Secretary.
Well, indeed, and therefore that somewhat undermines anything he might say about something else.
But it also keeps him out of the way. He's in jail,
well,
doesn't it?
It does, but I think that the fundamental point I will repeat, that the security services in this country have used paedophilia as a means of blackmail.
Okay, Alexander Litvinenko, the murder inquiry, the 5 unanswered questions at the end of the proceedings was the article by Mary Dzhevsky in The Independent. But Litvinenko, what's going on with this guy?
I think that people need to read his book, Blowing Up Russia, because the main allegation in that is not that Putin is a criminal, but that Putin blew up Moscow, blaming the Chechens, and that Litvinenko himself had been involved in it. In other words, false flag terror. False flag terror in Moscow, false flag terror in London, false flag terror in New York.
And what's
that's
the
real world.
What's the link to Berezovsky?
Berezovsky was Putin's ally at the time, and then eventually became an ally of the Western oligarchs. It's a very murky subject, but we've had very little time to go into the full details.
Finally, the SAS dressing up as ISIS fighters undercover in Syria.
Yes, so in other words, the Parliament's been told that we're not intervening in Syria, but according to the evidence of the Daily Express, the SAS are already in there against the Parliament's express disapproval.
Have they got any permission from the Security Council of the United Nations?
No, they've got no basis to be there at all, and they're probably engaged in attacks on Assad's forces rather than on ISIS, because ISIS is an ally of the Western powers.
Okay, time to sign off now. The Murdoch News at 7, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. No, we're off to the Balloon Fiesta this week. On our sister show, Dialect, next Tuesday, you can hear from blacksmith Simon Summers and former job centre worker who resigned over targets for sanctioning the unemployed. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. You can find all our links on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Please join us for the politics show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
On the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the Royal College of Anaesthetists is sceptical of reports a property Jenson Button and his wife were staying in could have been gassed by thieves. £300,000 worth of goods were stolen. Police on the French Riviera, where they were staying, have said it's not uncommon for properties there to be pumped with anaesthetics before a raid. Dr. Liam Brennan is from the Royal College.
It just wouldn't be possible. To get somebody to be unconscious, you would have to have concentrations well in excess of 90%. And of course, if you're giving the atmosphere with that much nitrous oxide in it, there would be no oxygen to go along with it.
Cilla Black's body has been flown back to Britain. The singer and TV star died of a stroke after falling at a Spanish villa last weekend. Lord Janna has been ordered to go to court to face a series of historical sex abuse allegations. The chief magistrate considered medical evidence about the elderly former Labour peer's severe dementia, but concluded he was fit to attend. He denies allegations of abuse. Eurotunnel says security measures introduced recently have brought the number of people trying to get to the UK back under control. It emerged earlier that the government has considered closing the Channel Tunnel at night as a last resort. Meanwhile, the United Nations says more needs to be done to address the migrant crisis in Calais. Melissa Fleming is from the UN's Refugee Agency.
We have made this call, and we've been making it time and again, for an urgent, comprehensive and sustainable response, and also to the terrible reception conditions for refugees and migrants in Calais.
It's been reported that World Football's governing body has launched an internal investigation into alleged corruption. FIFA has appointed a US law firm to conduct the inquiry, which will run parallel to two others by authorities in the United States and Switzerland. In sports, England's cricketers are potentially just 3 wickets away from regaining the Ashes urn. The tourists have closed on 241 for 7 in their second innings, trailing by 90 runs. Ben Stokes claimed 5 wickets. That's the latest. I'm Charlie Maggs.